Welcome to the Eucatastrophe, where we meander through politics, pop culture, church, and society to consider true human ends and how life may be enchanted. I'm Joel, joined as always by my co-host Dave Taylor. And today, before we get to our topic, I wanted to just mention how Dave is about to travel to a faraway land, a land we may call the poor man's New Zealand. Otherwise known as Tasmania. Dave is going to go there and give two talks. The first one is on loneliness and the search for the self. If you're in Tasmania listening, apologies for that last statement, but go see Dave speaking. And then he's also going to give a second talk to a group of men of the cloth. Probably is men, isn't it?
I'm not sure.
I hope there's a woman too. Anyway. And the talk is, what can we learn from cultural Marxism? So Dave's given these two talks. If you're down there, do check them out. But what can we learn from cultural Marxism? David, isn't the answer the face of the enemy?
I should say that in the title that I gave, cultural Marxism is in quotation marks, because I don't think it exists.
Oh.
But we can learn a lot from things that don't exist.
Like what?
Jedis and
why,
Sith.
Why are you saying that? Why do you assume? There's a great interview that CPX did with Alison Milbank, in which she talks about, you know, why do you think fairies don't exist, David?
Fairies are different to Jedis, mate.
Why?
Because fairies exist.
My son has a lightsaber.
Oh, okay.
And he's going to grow up to prove you wrong.
Okay, so we're going to have to get into some modal logic here, aren't we? If lightsaber.
That's right. Yeah, okay. Yeah. What is the byline of this? What can we learn from cultural Marxism? I should say that we intend to maybe pilfer this for our own purposes later. Yeah. But what's the byline?
So I'm talking about basically how a lot of the things that people are rightly or wrongly concerned with, stuff that they associate with cultural Marxism, kind of quite corrosive forms of identity politics and an overly combative public sphere and things like that. I'm suggesting that the things that people are concerned about in those regards aren't products of anything connected with Marxism, but are actually related to capitalism and liberalism, that they're necessary features, or they're the logical progression of capitalism.
Gosh.
And so I'm saying that universities aren't hotbed of Marxism. They're actually the most neoliberal substantiations.
That all sounds really complicated. I would rather just have a two-word phrase that I could just bandy around willy-nilly in order to just characterize my enemies. Isn't it just so much easier to say cultural Marxism as like a magic hand waving?
Yeah. So, radical orthodoxy.
All right, today's episode, this week's episode, we're going to be entering what David mentioned before to me as a bit of the confessional, which gets me nervous immediately because I'm not very much into the whole open book Joelness sometimes. Anyway, what we're going to be looking at, we're trying to capture something today of the perils and the turning away from what we may call closed systems or all too neat understandings of Christianity, even indeed systems of Christianity that may even veer into a form of fundamentalism that we, David and I, that is, experienced differently but with some overlap in our youths. And then maybe something of alternatives, how we may, in the wake of that, those all too neat or closed understandings, how we may pursue alternatives that continue to joyfully journey through orthodoxy.
Yeah, so this is part of my ongoing plan to get Joel in touch with his feelings, to help him confront
I am in touch with my feelings. The reality is that you can tell because I shout them all the time. Yeah. Like I'm an open... Anyway.
Both feelings, anger and sarcasm.
Yeah, that's right.
To begin with, I wanted to talk a bit about my own background. I've talked about this at length in a talk. Maybe I'll link that on our Facebook page. But this kind of comes out of reflections on my own kind of theological development. Without kind of giving my entire life story, my kind of theological journey kind of, I suppose, starts in my kind of late primary school when I started going along to a Presbyterian youth group. So I was christened a Catholic, Roman Catholic, but not really raised in the church at all. I only went to church a handful of times throughout my childhood up until then. And going to this youth group, I immediately latched on to the Christian faith and the Bible. This is for a number of reasons. I think I was a young person who had a really kind of almost pathological fear of death. I was also someone that always, ever since I could remember, had a deep belief in God, but and actually longed for a church community and things like that, but didn't have access to that because my family wasn't practicing in that way. And so as soon as I started going to Bible study and things like that, I fell in love with kind of the Reformed Protestant understanding of Christianity, the evangelical understanding of Christianity. And I latched onto it. And this has had a number of different facets. So I had, to put it lightly, a kind of troubled childhood. I didn't go to school very much. I missed, probably by the end of my school career, I missed about half of my classes through truancy and things like that, just through being kind of a troubled youth and things like that.
Didn't have the way of the Jedi.
But coming from that kind of background, and not having a lot of self-esteem, not having ever developed a sense of kind of self-efficacy, especially in terms of academic or intellectual pursuits, I was able to kind of latch onto theology in a really deep way. I found that I had a natural inclination towards understanding the Bible systematically. I understood how the Bible connects as a coherent whole, how different authors make allusions that are picked up on throughout the scriptures, even though it was written by different authors. And I actually ended up being praised by this, especially by a lot of older men in my life, older than me, that is. And that was something that was kind of irreplaceable as an experience for me, as someone that had never achieved anything intellectually, to be praised for my intellectual capacity in this way. And so I latched onto it. And I got so much out of this evangelical theological system. It made sense of the world. It made sense of myself, who, having a kind of difficult childhood, already felt alienated from the world, and as if the world is a very hostile place. The church kind of gave a story, or the evangelical tradition gave a story that I could kind of tell myself about that I was part of this kind of predestined minority within society that was being saved, and I didn't need to worry about the ugly chaos of the world outside, because I could because that was going to pass away with the old order of things when Christ comes to make everything new. The other thing that it gave me was it gave me a structure for understanding everything. So one thing people often get wrong about conservative religious people is they think that they're anti-intellectual. But I think there's actually a type of hyper-intellectualism or hyper-rationality connected with that form of religion. There is an answer for every question that you could imagine, because they still exist. The reason they still exist is that they've come up with answers for everything. And this is where I think the problem comes. So I became very good at understanding the Calvinist, and that was the tradition that I was in, the Calvinist answer to everything. But the problem with this for me ended up being was that because it was a whole system, each answer to a question was dependent on another answer and another and another. And if one answer ends up failing, the whole system is threatened with falling down. And so there was underneath it all a certain level of doubt and behind it all. And so much of the time, I've seen it over and over again, this system collapses for people. It's shown up to be too rigid, too brittle a system of explanation. But I've probably disclosed enough about my own upbringing.
Well, it's interesting what you're saying there, because it's hyper-rationalistic, which is, I think, a really important point. Hmm. So hyper-rationalistic within its own commitments, or what sometimes people would then refer to as worldview, right?
Yeah.
And I think there's a social practices around that as well. So it leads to discourse that is entirely orientated internally, to manning the own ramparts of the of the fortification, the castle, and so on, preaching to the choir, for example, or own internal conferences, or you know, these are church contexts that often have an absence of traditional ecclesial authority, right? Apostolic authority, and yet they engage in announcements of apostasy. So there's a there's practices around it as well, sort of internal clear understanding of who's in and out, in order to maintain that distinction. My background is, you know, slightly different, as that I come from a originally a charismatic Pentecostal, but I think there's still large echoes, right? So this system of rules and the sort of schema that it creates has within it, in both contexts, I think, a sort of puritanical streak. In my own context, you know, there's the question, well, why must you be good? Why be good? And it turns into holiness as a sort of prohibition. There's a set of rules. So no Harry Potter. That's kind of like one of the things for some of the kids, probably younger than me. But also your goodness may just simply be evidence, demonstrating as evidence of your salvific moment that you're one of the people, right? There's a certain, it's not to be good is part of the process of ethical formation that means the life of a Christian, but so more so that goodness is evidence of that you are actually inside this class of people, right? Now, I think for me, this raised a whole bunch of almost existential problems when I was growing up. And in particular, I found it difficult as a matter of politics increasingly, because it seemed increasingly just complicit with ordinary politics. You know, you're saved, you're part of this community, but then what? Why even be at church if you're, if it's simply about this intellectual schema in your case, or in my case, the salvific moment and so on? Why form this community? So there's an individualism at the heart of this as well.
That was in my tradition, it was quite explicit. The common line was, standing in a garage doesn't make you a car is one of the things that they'd always say, or going to McDonald's doesn't make you a hamburger. This idea that going to church has not like nothing to do with being a Christian.
Well, I mean, just to bring it back to last week, I mean, one evangelical minister in this context, his criticism of the Benedict option is that it made the church central rather than Christ. That sort of distinction there. Now, to my mind, growing up and then hearing that sort of thing, that basically allows people off the hook in some ways. You don't have to engage in ethical formation, because in my context, it was just you had that moment, or in your context, you had the intellectual schema or and the moment as well, right? So, and this seemed to me ultimately complicit with a liberal order, or as I was increasingly thinking of it in those terms, because salvation's acquired almost in that contractarian moment, leaving me free to pursue goods and accumulate stuff. And that actually was kind of like the life of, and that's how I began to perceive the life in the Pentecostal context. Now, I want to put a caveat. There's a, like you emphasizing, there's a lot of gifts that were given through that heritage as well, right? But this is more about the tensions that were felt. You know, so it's very Weberian, in fact, that there was an understanding of almost like you go out into the market and you accumulate goods or capital, and that is evidence of your, you know, that you're part, that you're, it's either something distinct, as in the market and so on, is distinct from this thing we do in church, which is the salvation moment, or it's an evidence of you're doing goodness to show that you're part of this saved flock, right? You know, and at the very least, then what it meant was you had, you know, a certain complicity with, you know, being in the market and so on, because your job was effectively to make money, to then give out of the generosity of that money back to the church, so that the church could go about its own business of saving souls. So the church in its own way became this sort of market, or this capitalist sort of industry, in which the goal was to accumulate more souls in the same way that in your other life it was to accumulate stuff.
I suppose in my spiritual upbringing, it was more ascetic, I suppose, in that there was a sense in which labor and work was instrumentalized. So you produce enough funds that you can then put back into ministry and support ministry. That was the kind of goal of labor. And then there was also a strong emphasis on the highest calling being that of ministry.
Right.
So you go into either mission work or ministering a church or whatever.
Yeah.
I suppose I should actually say that I don't want to sound ungrateful to this tradition, because I think one of the things that I said in the talk where I talked about these things was I got so much out of this. I don't think I would have survived without this religion. And this makes me very, very sympathetic to people caught up in all sorts of religious traditions. But there was so much good. I ended up being fostered as a teenager by a Presbyterian minister, so I can't complain too much.
Mine is the same. I mean, there are certain gifts and inheritance. So, you know, in a Pentecostal context, there is that sense of, well, perhaps all is not as it seems.
Mm.
There is something potentially mysterious.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think there was this kind of, how do I put it? It's almost like a narrative of discipline. So there was this notion that, like, I'm absolutely set free by Christ.
Mm.
But then also you're subject to the absolute discipline of, say, the strong man or the strong God.
Yeah, sure,
or
sure.
The absolute discipline of the strong state. So it wasn't unusual to be in Pentecostal context where people were talking about freedom and this, but at the same time they wanted a kind of a law and order state.
Yeah.
Right. And that is set down for your liberty, supposedly, in order to then get on with the job of saving souls, for example.
So I suppose where I would want to kind of take this conversation is thinking about, at least in my context, the kind of explanatory power of a theological system when that explanatory power is challenged through questions arising and questions they inevitably do. So big questions for me arose around things like the authority of Scripture. One of the very first real doubts I came across was, you know, my evangelical background was insistent on the infallibility of Scripture. There was no both theological or historical errors in the Scriptures. And so you had to do a lot of fancy hermeneutical footwork to get around contradictions and things like that. But then I also thought, well, where does the authority of Scripture come from? If it was the church that actually authorized the canon. And that made me think, oh gosh, maybe the church is more important than I am realizing. And I also see that the Scriptures itself don't prescribe a canon, nor do they give us a sense of the authority of itself in the way that my theology led it to believe. And so that made me think, oh, actually, I need something other than Scripture to hang all this stuff on. That was my kind of first doubt. But that's just an example of when this structure, superstructure, starts wobbling. And
Just on that, I mean, just to say a slight point of contrast, for me, it's not so much, there wasn't like an intellectual... It was probably the absence of intellectualism in some of this context, but then also that, there was both the politics of it, increasingly at tension with an understanding of maybe actually our task is the formation of people and the communities as such. And then secondly, probably this idea that, well, you just have that moment, you know, that moment in which then I have to have this authentic expression of that moment and, you know, exhibited in love and so on. And whereas I was becoming more attracted to the understanding that maybe there's a journey over time in which I engage in these small practices and accumulate and, you know, form a community with others who are doing this together and so on.
Yeah. Whereas for me, it was your salvation is predestined and you have no power over it. So you're never sure whether you're saved. Properly saved, and there's just utter uncertainty if you're someone who is like me, who is anxious about these things.
That's like Weber's point. How do you evidence that salvation?
So that's why you're good. You're good not to earn salvation.
Yeah.
You're good to evidence prove it to yourself that you are saved, which is so much worse than trying to earn your salvation,
right.
at least in my view. But
And for Weber, it can lead to then you can desacralize it and then create that space of hard work becomes desacralized and just becomes kind of the bourgeois capitalist man. Can I just have one passage from Weber?
Because
it really captures a lot of what I just when I read this, I remember later in life thinking, yes, you know, he says there's a specifically bourgeois economic ethic had grown up with the consciousness of standing in the fullness of God's grace and being visibly blessed by him. The bourgeois businessman, as long as he remained within the bounds of formal correctness, as long as his moral conduct was not objectionable, could follow his pecuniary interests as he would, and feel that he was fulfilling a duty in doing so.
That sounds familiar. But so what happens when this structure gets challenged? So this happened for me. Most of my late teens through even my 20s was a time of kind of tumultuous kind of doubt and things like that. It's really struggling to understand, make sense of being a Christian and things like that, and living quite, well, not living quite, my kind of theological and spiritual kind of commitments were just very chaotic. But this is something I observed countless times in different people. So I've seen so many people who were raised in this part, or even were teachers of this kind of religion, who something comes up and the whole system falls apart. Now they've rejected it completely. And I'm interested in the types of responses that this leads to. What does it look like when this system fails people? And there's kind of two approaches that I've seen happening. The first is very common on my Twitter feed, actually, which is, it's what I'd call kind of post-evangelicalism. Some people actually identify with this term. This is a response that I think it seeks to reject this evangelicalism that has been hurtful in many ways, and we should say like very legitimate ways. So people might be damaged by the way in which evangelical churches have treated women, or treated the LGBT community, or just be deeply traumatized by their loss of faith, or something like that. So post-evangelicals, they reject evangelicalism, but they maintain their identity in relationship to it. And I think that this is not a good approach to going through the storms of doubting your theological system. It makes me think a bit of grief or trauma. So if someone goes for a grief or goes for a trauma, it is very normal to have all sorts of complex responses to that experience. And that will be shaping your very existence for a very long time. But the hope for going through something like that is that you'll eventually kind of come to some sort of peace about it. And you can tell when someone has kind of failed to process a trauma in a healthy way when they maintain a fixation on it for their entire life, and every conversation returns to it. You might know people like that. I've certainly come across people like that. And I feel like this with people who identify as post-evangelicalism. So any conversation about theology or Christianity has to involve a conversation about the foibles of Reformed evangelicalism.
Yeah, so I think that's right. And that's tragic in that somebody needs to work through that.
Yeah.
But you could have a different form as well that I think at its worst, a kind of post-evangelicalism goes into, in which it takes the worst forms of evangelicalism, the worst elements of at least some forms of evangelicalism, and then it continues with them, but in a different vein. So it takes the understanding of your life as an individual narrative. You know, we talked about that individualized moment of salvation, or the individual relationship to God, or trying to prove yourself in various fields. It takes that individualized narrative and it furthers it.
Yeah.
So it then says, well, you know, I discovered that actually life was not about the strictures here and so on, but it was about discovering me.
Yeah.
Which in ways is just in sort of a certain continuity, right?
Yeah.
That the personal relationship of Christianity morphs quite easily into seeking one's own individuality.
Yeah.
So there's, in either context, you're not dealing with the notion that, well, maybe life is about a shared formation or a transformation of the person in response to a divine truth, for example.
Yeah, that's right. And I'm hoping that the stage that I'm at now with my theological and Christian development is that I can now just kind of incorporate that evangelical, I don't know what I I don't have a label for myself at the moment in these terms, but I just incorporate that. That's just part of my story. That's part of the things that have flavored my
what is your label at the moment? Confused.
Anglican. But
oh yeah, Anglican, confused.
Yeah, confused. Wishy-washy. but you know what I'm saying, and I think there's a analogy with grief or trauma there, that you actually just need to make that just part of yourself. It's part of your story now. That's what I hope to do with evangelicalism in a healthy way, to say.
It is true. I mean, if I go to a hard charismatic church these days, I sit there, my teeth are gritted.
Yeah.
Is that a word? Teeth gritted?
Yeah.
Okay. Yep, I'm using real words. That's important. I do find that my body just actually, because it just, you know, it's, I guess it's what people call that sort of emotional reaction or whatever, you know, it is very difficult.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And so part of that is, like, I think the hope there would be to process that.
Yes, that's right. So actually I do find that now, yes, I do find now there is a sense of trying to find the solidness of being a solidity that allows you to still be open to others, so that you don't see them as just simply the terrors of your youth anymore, but actually you're generous towards that.
Yeah. Yeah. And remembering, you know, that evangelicalism has gifted me with a great respect and knowledge of scripture. Even the idea of an individual relationship with God, well, I now problematize that. That the centrality of actually making sure that you do take that relationship seriously, that is a gift. Yeah.
Also the idea that you can be the big man on campus.
Far out. So I suppose that's one response that I wanted to talk about. Very briefly, I think the other response again, it's completely understandable, is a lot of times people respond to the shaking up of their rigid theological system by becoming militant atheists. This is a response that I see, I've seen a lot of times, especially, funnily enough, although it probably makes complete sense, from people who took it upon themselves to be the defenders of the Reformed evangelical faith from outside criticism. So people who get very interested in apologetics of the William Lane Craig style. So giving the positivistic answer to every philosophical question that comes up. I've seen so many people who were once so passionate about being that person who are now the absolute shadow of that. So they now become the apologists for atheism and have the exact same epistemology there. And in the same way as post-evangelicals, they remain in dialogue with evangelicalism, or they maintain their identity intellectually in relationship to evangelicalism.
A version of it.
Yeah. And they emulate the epistemology of evangelicalism. So it's reductionistic and hyper-rationalistic. And I've talked to so many people in that situation. And again, it seems to be this lack of ability to truly transcend the categories handed down to you by the thing that you're rejecting, to actually say, well, maybe there is an alternate approach to knowing that might be available to me. Have you come across?
Well,
people
I think that, but I think also there is that clear echo. So this isn't surprising. So fundamentalism more generally is a mirror to modern rationalism, in which you have clear non-negotiable messages that are ahistorical in the sense that they're outside of the mediations of history, community, and tradition.
Yeah.
That they're deemed open to be, in the fundamentalist context, these are clear messages that are open to the individual from God, or in the naturalistic context of sort of modern rationalism, that they are clear natural facts, right? That are just a domain of clear natural facts.
Yeah.
So there clearly is that mirror image of each other. I think this is right. And I think, you know, what you're pointing to as well is that in this context, you seem to have this dynamic in which you're almost presented with two options. One, if you remain closed within the hermeneutic circle, as it were, you're going to probably collapse and fall away, and then you have these options that you're presenting, or you double down, and like, and that's it.
That's
where you can go with this. And so you're identifying people that you meet who used to be the most hardcore, and that very hardcore nature, the way they've developed it, probably leads to a certain brittleness, because at the point where it's challenged, it has nowhere to fall back on. Because if one of these, if one of these clear non-negotiable facts falls off, then the whole system can collapse, right? Or alternatively, no, you just keep on doubling down on that.
I mean, last week I talked about the evils of pathologizing people and things like that, but I can't help but think that there's a certain element of repression going on here. So the people that speak the most about the obvious truthfulness of their beliefs that are actually masking some deep-seated doubts about it, and the reason they need to keep on insisting strongly in the indubitability of their doctrines might actually be harboring doubts.
I think, you know, we should, I mean, we're not entire, I don't think we've, you know, we're not presenting a clear, here's the alternative and so on, right? So, but we are saying potentially here that we're not trying to reify doubt and say doubt is the real thing. Definitely not saying that. It's more a case of saying, well, maybe what if orthodoxy were a place to begin with for an expansive, joyful journey in which there is this unfolding that takes place, in which there is actually a quest to respond to the divine and to explore what that is through the deepness of the Christian tradition, through the deepness of the history it presents, through the deepness of the practices it is, in which there is a certain mystery involved, in which there is not necessarily always the clear non-negotiable answer, but nevertheless an understanding that we are processing towards an end, a discernible and understandable, a completion.
We don't have much time to talk about kind of genuine alternatives to this, but I love what you've just said. But it reminds me as well of something that I've been, we'll talk about this in the next episode a bit as well. I've been reading a lot of Charles Taylor in preparation for those talks that we mentioned at the beginning, and Taylor kind of talks about how and a lot of other people do as well, that there are kind of two clear modern versions of religious belief and identification. One of them is this strict identity marker, exclusory mode of religiosity. And one of them is this marketplace of spiritual beliefs and ideas that you can kind of construct, you can kind of pick and mix your spirituality. And he, and the idea there being that both of those are actually very modern phenomena. The conservative is not just less kind of in touch with the times, as they're often accused of. They're very much in touch with the times, and the challenge for the Christian in our age is to somehow non-defensively be able to sit and find themselves in a tradition, and I don't know what the answer and solution to that is. It is a profound challenge, because that's almost not an option in our in our kind of secular ages, Taylor calls it. But nonetheless, I think that's what we need to be aiming for. And if I can just use one example of a kind of gestalt shift that happened for me in conversation with our friend Byron. I remember I was in the middle of a big doubt in my late 20s, as I always was. And I ended up saying to my friend Byron, why should I believe in God? And Byron just said, oh, because he loves you. And that sounds like a stupid and flippant answer. But all of a sudden that radically shifted my thinking, because all of a sudden God wasn't something to be whose existence needed to be justified. I needed to, my existence needed to be justified. God became the fixed place in the world. And I needed to come into relationship with that epistemologically. And the problem with defense systems of religion in modern terms is they're always trying to create some sort of Tower of Babel intellectually to God, try and construct from the ground up an intellectual system where you won't be able to entertain the opposite of the existence of God. But I think true Orthodox religion, you must begin with God as the presupposition, and yourself even becomes the secondary phenomenon. Mm. And that's actually how I turned a corner. I started thinking, oh no, like I come to the world with God because I can do nothing else.
And how joyful that can be.
Yeah, and that was incredibly liberating.
As in it's actually as against this anxiety of sort of a Puritan streak,
yeah,
the rules, the closed system,
yeah,
the sheer pleasure that is entailed, and then beginning there and then reflecting and acting upon that.
Yeah. Well, that's a great place to wrap it up. Thanks so much for joining us. Please like us, drop us a review, follow us on Twitter. You can find us at UCAT, that's EUCAT _ podcast. So you can search for us on Facebook, The UCatastrophe. And we will see you next week as we talk about the idea of authenticity. See you then.